I invite you to open a Bible to Judges chapter 3, and if you want to use the Pew Bible in front of you, that's page 235, Judges chapter 3, or page 235. This morning, we're going to look at three judges that all come in Judges chapter 3, and this trio of judges, like all the judges, pushes our hearts towards the one that can deliver us. That these judges in the book of Judges were tasked with saving and rescuing Israel, but it's a picture that their failure should show us what Christ is able to do and did do at the cross. And so Hebrews says he can save them to the uttermost. And so what I'd like to do is introduce you to three judges. I'm sure that these are not major figures, major names, and here names like Samson, we know it comes to mind. These are three less familiar judges. And all three of them are put together in this chapter, and I want to draw out four principles after that we'll call the drama of deliverance. Four things that maybe pushes our hearts towards the Christmas story. Let me introduce you to the judges. The first one comes in verse 7. It begins there. The Israelites did evil in the sight of the Lord. They forgot the Lord their God, and they served Baals and Ashtaroths. Look at verse 9. But when they cried out to the Lord raised for them a deliverer, Othniel. And Othniel, by the way, is related to Caleb. The second judge, and we're just skimming the surface here, the second story begins in verse 12. Once again, the Israelites did evil in the sight of the Lord. And because they did this evil, the Lord gave Eglon, the king of Moab, power over Israel. Verse 13 says that Eglon even took over the city of Palms, that's Jericho. And then look at verse 15. Again, the Israelites cried out to the Lord, and he gave them a deliverer, Ehud, a left-handed man from Gera, the Benjaminite. Judge number 3 comes in verse 31. After Ehud came Shamgar of Anath, who struck down 600 Philistines with an ox goad. He too saved Israel. And so we have three kind of unusual characters, unusual judges. Let me give you the story of these three judges. We'll mark out each one of them. And then I want to show how this should push our hearts a little bit towards the Christmas story. You can have a lot of fun with the book of Judges because these characters are so animated. So here's what I want you to notice about Othniel. And you can write this on your outline if you choose. Othniel, when you think of Othniel, he in the book of Judges is presented as the ideal judge. He's the ideal judge. Everything that could be right with a judge, you know, is right with Othniel. He's the knight in shining armor. If you line up all the judges in the book of Judges and you say, now, which one of these do you think just oozes success? Everybody's going to point to Othniel. Othniel has that something that tells you that he can get the job done. Othniel is considered a model judge in the book of Judges. That's why he comes first, by the way, for a number of reasons. Number one, he comes from a very faithful family. We pointed out in the text here that he is related to Caleb. Now remember, in the Bible, Caleb is one of the two spies that was faithful to God. The spies went out in the land. Several of them brought back an evil report. Only two really put their faith in God. Caleb is one of those two. This Othniel is related to that faithful Caleb. And so Othniel has a stellar pedigree. There is no doubt that Othniel, for example, is a contrast with Shamgar. Notice, and we'll say this in a minute, verse 31, Shamgar, the son of Anath. Anath is some kind of pagan god. And so his family was into some kind of idolatry. He may or may not be a natural Israelite. At the minimum, his family got associated with paganism. So Othniel, lock it in, is the ideal judge. By the way, he married an ideal Israelite. Remember last week we talked about that little love story out of chapter 1 where Othniel marries this woman, Asha? Asha, in Judges, is considered a model Israelite wife. She's a contrast, for example, with somebody like Delilah. So Othniel not only has a stellar pedigree, but apparently he's cultivating a lot of the right things in his marriage. And mind you, by this time, many of the men in Israel are marrying those outside of their religion, and it's kind of drawing their hearts in the wrong direction. And so this woman, Asha, Othniel's wife, she's presented as a real model of what it looks like for somebody in that culture to love God. Othniel is also connected to Judah. He not only has a faithful family and a faithful wife, but he's connected to Judah. Judah is the tribe that's highlighted in chapter 1. Judah is that tribe that had the initial success when they got into the land. They're like, the when you thought about a tribe winning the right battles in chapter 1, they're what comes to mind. Judah is the one that looked at that other tribe, Simeon, and said, come with us, we can do this. It's just a picture of faithfulness here. All the marks that you would think of a faithful person seem to be in Othniel's life. He's a model judge. He is the poster child of what you would want in a judge. This is a guy that comes into the story to save the princess. The author of Judges is saying something like this. This is how you do it, my friends. Take a look at Othniel. And just when you think all the judges are going to follow in the likeness of Othniel, we get to this one called Ehud. Everything about Ehud is awkward. He's the awkward judge. We could take all day and go through the story of Ehud. He is antithetical to Othniel. Othniel is the knight in shining armor. Ehud, he's like the Three Musketeers, you know? In fact, if we were reading a newspaper back in this day, it would say something like, Ehud, the left-handed assassin. It would say something like that. Because that's exactly what Ehud does in his battle. So let me give you a couple of thoughts about this Three Musketeer type Ehud. Number one, he in this story is presented as kind of an awkward person. Verse 15 says this, and again, we're just skimming the surface here. It says, he gave them a deliverer, middle of verse, Ehud, a left-handed man. Now, we don't exactly know what that phrase left-handed man means. If we were reading the Hebrew, it would read this way, he was hindered in his right hand. That's how it really is. So some people believe, for example, that Ehud had a deformed right hand and he had to use his left hand. That's very possible. Others believe, and some generals would do this in the ancient world, you would bind the right-handed people so they learned at a very young age to fight with the left hand. You got to remember that in most warfare, it's righty on righty. When you come out later in the book of Judges with like 700 left-handed soldiers, right-handed soldiers don't know how to go against something like that. So a lot of these early generals from a young age, they grab a bunch of men and they bind their right arms for a good part of their life so they learned how to battle with the left hand. It gave them a statistical advantage over the enemies. It's possible that Ehud is one of these. Oh, by the way, what's really bizarre is, you know, he's a Benjaminite. You know what that means? Benjaminite is the right-handed tribe, and he's a lefty. Everything about this man is awkward. Some believe that this is a reference to being ambidextric. You could use either one of your hands. That's how the Greek interpretation of this is. The Greek fathers took it this way. And no matter how we take this hindered in the right hand, the author is presenting this man as just kind of awkward. He's just different. He's coming at things from a very different angle. And the reason this is important is this. When Ehud goes in to talk to Eglon, this king, who he's about to, it's a very oppressive king, and Ehud's about to start a battle with Moab by assassinating the king. When he goes in, guess what they do? They frisk him on the right side, right? Rather the left side, because that's how a righty pulls out a sword. This is a lefty. He goes from the other side. They fail to frisk the other side, and the lefty again has the advantage. So no matter how you understand this left-handed thing, something's awkward here. This guy is deviating from the script. Number two, he makes an awkward weapon. Verses 16 through 22, which we're not going to jump into detail, but Ehud goes and crafts a double-edged sword about a foot in length, and he improvises here a weapon that would be perfect in order to carry out this particular war. You need a sword that's long enough to get the job done, but short enough to smuggle into the room. And Ehud is very precise, very calculated, and very careful, and he crafts a very awkward weapon. He does a very awkward assassination. He goes into the room and he says to the king, I have a debar for you, I have a secret for you. And the king clears the whole room out because the king thinks he's about to get some secret message. And that's when Ehud carries out an assassination, eventually leads to the freedom of the people of Israel. He makes this incredibly awkward escape. The king is in the room alone on the floor and Ehud's already jumped out the window. Again, it's a Three Musketeers kind of scene here. There's an awkward progression. You know, throughout the book of Judges and the book of Joshua, you defeat the army, then you capture the king. This is the only place that I know where they capture the king and then go defeat the army. All that to say, everything about Ehud is awkward. We go from Othniel, that ideal judge, the one where everything kind of goes according to plan, and then we find ourselves looking at just the opposite, Ehud, a very awkward kind of judge. And so Othniel is the ideal judge, Ehud is the awkward judge, and Shamgar, I don't know what to say, he's the unusual judge. Now look at verse 31. After Ehud came Shamgar of Anath, who struck down 600 Philistines with an ox goad. He too saved Israel. Now think about how precise and calculated Ehud was. Ehud, who knew he had to get this sword into a room in order to do something specific here, he thought to himself, has to be, 12 inches, has to be double-edged, has to look like this, I got to carry it on this side instead of this side. Everything about Ehud is so calculated and so precise. And then we get to this guy Shamgar, who is just random. Grabs an ox goad in the middle of a battle and ends up delivering Israel. There's just everything about Shamgar is unusual. He's got an unusual weapon, an ox goad, some kind of farming or agricultural implement, not a traditional weapon of war. He's got a very questionable style. He's got that Samson type thing going. This is no Othniel. This is no Ehud. He's improvised in his battle. I would say he's brute strength. Shamgar just comes off as random. And he's got a very questionable lineage, too. It's rather unusual that Shamgar, who comes from this Anath, by the way, Anath was a Canaanite god of war. And so his lineage is not that clean lineage like Othniel's, or maybe like Ehud's. This man Shamgar is just, he's just unusual. Everything about him is unusual. So in chapter 3, notice what the author does. He goes from a very model judge, an ideal judge, to kind of an awkward judge, to a very unusual judge, something that we might not expect. And so let's step back for a minute and kind of let our hearts push forward to the Christmas story. Say, what in the world could these judges have to do with the book of Matthew and Jesus born in a manger? Well, let me give you four thoughts, okay, about the Christmas story from the book of Judges. Here's how we might anticipate it. Number one, I think we can say this. God delights in the dramatic. God delights in the dramatic. From Othniel the Great to Ehud the Lefty to Shamgar the who knows what. God delights in the dramatic. Dorothy Sayers, the great writer, put it this way. We may call the doctrine exhilarating, we may call it devastating, but if we call it dull, then words have no meaning at all. When you read through the book of Judges, the one thing we learn about God, if nothing else, is that God is anything but a dull God. He's a God of drama. In other words, God is going to be faithful to His promises. God is going to carry out all that He says He's going to do, but the script belongs to God. How God goes from point A to point B, He often gets there in a very dramatic fashion. Sometimes He'll use someone like Othniel, sometimes it's Ehud, and sometimes it's Shamgar with an ox goad. He is a God of drama. He's a very dramatic God. I mean, I was thinking about the Exodus, for example. Israel is enslaved, and think of all the things that God could have done to have Israel delivered there from Egypt. You know what He could have done? He could have frozen all the Egyptians, just frozen them right there. And Israel could have just walked out of the country and gone to the promised land. In the New Testament, Philip, the evangelist, he gets whisked away just like that. A man is baptized, and then you turn around, and Philip's gone. God moved him somewhere else. God could do that with Israel. He could have just looked down and said, okay, all of you now, out of Egypt, into the promised land, and nobody saw that coming. Now, he could have done this. He could have, you know how it says it hardened Pharaoh's heart? He could have softened Pharaoh's heart, right? Pharaoh could have come out and said, God's been speaking to me lately, you know, and I feel like it's time to let this nation go. But what God does there is anything except dull. There is so much drama in the Exodus and how God delivers His people there. I mean, what God does is this. He hardens Pharaoh's heart. He sends the plagues. Egypt chases Israel. They're swallowed by the sea. And I say with Dorothy Sayers, you call it exhilarating, you call it devastating, but if we call it dull, words have no meaning at all. God is indeed a God of drama. In Genesis, He saves Israel from starvation. There's a famine in the land, and God rescues His people from starvation. He could have done this any way He wanted. He could have rained down manna from heaven, which He will do later in the book of Numbers. The Lord could have had animals move from one line to another line, and there would be food there. But what God does is incredibly dramatic in saving Israel. I mean, think about it. The youngest brother is sold into slavery, accused of a sex crime he did not commit. He interprets a dream, rises to the top of the world's most powerful empire, disguises himself to his brothers, and then saves the world from starvation. Call it devastating, call it exhilarating, but if you call it dull, words have no meaning at all. The one thing we learn when we look at these three judges is there is a drama to the redemption. And when we think about this, it reminds us that there's going to be a drama to the Christmas story. I mean, we should not find it a surprise that Jesus is born in a manger, and just a few miles away we have Herod, who's in a palace. How ironic that is. Think about the taxation in Luke chapter 2, where the whole world is taxed, and that causes David and Joseph and Mary to go to Bethlehem, where Jesus is born, where He fulfills the prophecy of being born in Bethlehem. Call it exhilarating, call it devastating. If you call it dull, words have no meaning at all. Dorothy Sayers is right. God is a God of drama. When we see all the drama in the book of Judges with the deliverance of God, it does not surprise us that there's a whole lot of drama that surrounds the Christmas story. It doesn't surprise us that Magi come from the east. It doesn't surprise us that Herod puts out this decree and it ends up moving Mary, Joseph, and Jesus right into the plan of God. I think what I'm saying is, when you read the book of Judges, you kind of scratch your head and say, I didn't see that one coming. And yet when I read the Christmas story, I find myself saying the same thing. I just didn't see that one coming. That's why Peter says, even the angels desire to look into these things. You know what that means? Yeah, the angels didn't see it coming either, and they've been watching for a long time. Call it exhilarating, call it anything except dull, because then words have no meaning at all. So the gospel story is dramatic. Number two, God delights in diversity. He delights in diversity, using different people and different personalities. One of the things that I've been thinking about in Judges, I've been meditating on this for some time, is the incredible diversity in the cast of characters that God uses in the book of Judges. Othniel comes from a really strong, faithful family. Shamgar comes from the opposite. He comes from the other side of the tracks, and yet God uses both of them. Othniel takes a very conventional approach that you would take to military warfare in that day. Ehud is a Three Musketeers type figure, and yet God uses both to deliver Israel. Even Shamgar, you know, if you look down at verse 31, I'll tell you how we should read this. Here, look at the last phrase, "He too saved Israel," period. And now, if I was translating this, you know what I would say? "He too saved Israel!" Exclamation point. This guy too, even Shamgar, saved Israel. Even a guy that you would never think could pull this off, God used him in a pretty profound way to rescue a very oppressed people in this time. And so God delights in diversity. God reaches out to an array of people, different personalities, different backgrounds. If we know from Judges that God reaches out to a diversity of people, does it surprise us that the shepherds are the first to show up at the manger? People that are considered unclean in that culture? Because if we were writing the story, who would show up to the manger first? It would be the priest. And it would be those that have kept the Levitical law. But we find in the drama of redemption that it's not the priest, and it's not the kings, and it's not the mighty of the world. Who is it? It's shepherds, and it's magi. Do you have any idea what the magi do, how much of that conflicts with Levitical law? And yet they're the ones that Matthew highlights as coming and worshiping, the first to rescue, worship Jesus in that way, are people like Shamgar. It's remarkable. Shouldn't surprise us that in the church we have Jew, Greek, male, female, free slave, as Paul says in the book of Galatians. God delights in using a diversity of people. He delights in using a diversity of personalities. This should not surprise us when we get to the New Testament and we find that in Jesus' band of men and his apostles, we have the white-collar Matthew, we got the blue-collar Peter. He calls a man named Matthew, who in that culture is someone that is sold out for the Romans. And then you have Simon the Zealot. You know what Simon the Zealot does for a living? Kills people like Matthew. He's a zealot, you know? Kills people that sell out in the Jewish culture. And yet both of them are called to follow Jesus as apostles. It shouldn't surprise us that we have really pragmatic people like Thomas, who say things like, you know, unless I see the piercings on him, I will not believe. To the very poetic John, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. There's diversity in the body of Christ. There's a diversity that God has brought together as the redeemed people. That God does not save people that are all the same, but people that are different. And He uses people in the church that are different. The gospel brings together people like Othniel and, frankly, people like Shamgar. And that's the beauty of the gospel. God delights, number three, in deliverance. He delights in deliverance. You know, when you read the text here, you can see how far Israel has fallen. What a fall from grace. Let me give you some thoughts. For example, look at verse 12. Once again, the Israelites did evil in the eyes of the Lord. And because they did this evil, the Lord gave Eglon, the king of Moab, power over Israel. Getting the Ammonites and the Amalekites to join him, Eglon came and attacked Israel, and he took possession of the city of Palms. That's Jericho. I want you to think about how far Israel fell, and yet God still rescues them time and time again. Notice, I mean, they're oppressed by the Moabites. You know what's strange about being oppressed by the Moabites? The Moabites were one of those nations that feared Israel during the Exodus. They're one of the nations that Israel actually put up a good battle against at the time. And earlier in the book of Judges, when God gives them a list of the nations that they're going to struggle with, Moab's not even in that list, because Moab isn't even a key player at that time when it was written. And yet here we are just a couple of decades later, and Moab is now the oppressor of Israel. This is unusual. This is lower than low. Number two, we didn't have time to unpack this story of Ehud, but they are oppressed by a buffoon king. I mean, the way that the author paints a picture of this Eglon is not a pretty picture. It's almost like painting a picture saying, can you believe this guy actually took over an entire nation? He's just a buffoon king. Everything that calls a fool in the book of Proverbs would associate with this man Eglon, this king. But even more than that, I want you to notice, this is how far God's people have fallen. They even lose the city of Jericho, the city of Palms. Think about this. That's the landmark city when Joshua crossed the Jordan. Remember Jericho? Walls fall down, you know, people go into the city. It's an amazing victory that Israel has. And here we are just generations later, and they lose the city of Jericho. How can this be? This is humiliating. This is lower than low. They've been conquered by a nation that wasn't even there to test them. They're oppressed by a buffoon king. The author shows that they lose the city of Jericho, their once great city. What does it show us that God comes and rescues people while they're all the way down that low? You know what it shows us? That God, that the grace of God comes to us, not because of our good works, but despite our good works. Because Israel does evil in the sight of the Lord, and that's when God comes and delivers. That's when He sends Shamgar. That's when He sends Ehud. When they're at their lowest point, when they have nothing to offer God, when in all right, God should turn His back on people that have turned their back on Him, that's the point when God sends a deliverer. That's the grace of God. Again, we have to get out of the mindset that God rescues good people. that if we're on our best behavior and we're doing things right and we're getting religious or, you know, we're really reaching out, then God will come and rescue us. It's not because of what we do. God rescues people despite what they do. Every other religion, this is where Christianity takes a different track. Every other religion in the world says that if you put your best foot forward, God will come and rescue you, whatever that looks like. Pray how many times a day? And that's when God, you know, really comes and saves. Go on this particular diet. Or worship in this temple this way. And that's how you gain the attention of God and He saves you. Become a good family man. Obviously, God will save you if you're a good family man. But what's happening in this text is the opposite. God is not rescuing a good people. God is rescuing a sinful people. A people that don't love Him. A people that have turned their back on God. And that's why Romans 5 is so powerful. Get this. While we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. While Israel was still serving other gods, God rescued them. Last thing I'll say is this. Number 4. I'm going to deviate from the D's here so I don't strain one. God delights in the unconventional. God delights in doing things that are unconventional. He uses the weak to confound the mighty. When you look at the judges, these are generally speaking not mighty men. Othniel is an exception. Samson is probably an exception. But Ehud is very restricted. Ehud is possibly handicapped, and yet he's the one that leads Israel out of oppression. Shamgar uses an ox goad and slays 600. This is remarkable. And the list doesn't end there. Put yourself in this culture. Put yourself in a culture where it was a male-dominated society, and in chapter 4, who is it that's leading the people to victory? It's Deborah. And then you have a non-entity, Gideon. Gideon is so afraid to lead Israel that he's hiding in a wine press, and yet that's the person God uses against the Midianites. Later on in the book of Judges, we have a bandit named Jephthah. Jephthah was just kind of a hooligan, is one of the translations. He had a band of men that followed him around, and yet God took him and rescued him, and he became a deliverer of Israel. Samson, again. Not all are in the likeness of Othniel. And what does that say? God uses the weak to confound the mighty. God doesn't take the mighty of this world and just use the mighty. He uses the things that are small and the things that are weak in order to promote His causes. 1 Corinthians 1:26 is a passage where the Apostle Paul says, look around you. Look around you. For consider your calling, brothers. He puts it that way. Consider your calling. Not many of you are wise according to worldly standards. Not many powerful, not many of noble birth. But God chose what is foolish in this world to shame the wise, what is weak to shame the strong. Think about what Paul is saying to the church. It's going to be a little offensive to church folks like us. You know, when Paul says, consider your calling, brothers, you know what he's saying? Look to the left, now look to the right, and just kind of look at who's around you in your local assembly. You know, how many of those are super rich people that can change the world like that with a swipe of a pen? How many governors do you have in your local assembly? How many people do you have in your assembly that can on a dime just start hiring people or sell a company or go do a project over here or go do a project over there? Not many mighty, Paul says. Not many wise by worldly standards. Not many powerful. Probably talking about wealth. And you know, and if you put yourself in the church at Corinth when Paul writes, picture this. They've never read this letter before, right? The letter gets delivered there. And somebody, they had in that culture, here's what you would do. You got to remember, this is an oral culture. So people didn't read the Bible, they often heard it read. You'd have one reader in the church and everybody else would listen. Revelation 1, verse 3 says, blessed is he that readeth and they that hear it. One reader, right? The number. And so one guy, probably the only guy in the church that can read, stands up in front of the church and he opens this letter, you know, from Paulus to the church at Corinth, right? And he gets to that verse. And maybe it's Apollos, because Apollos might have been the pastor there in Corinth. And he opens the scroll and he says, consider your calling, brothers. Not many wise, not many noble, you know? And I could just picture it, you know, elbowing each other, you know what I mean? I think he's talking about you, Joe, you know? Not many noble. Probably talking about this guy over here. You're kind of poking each other. Think about how real this is in that culture where you're thinking something must be wrong with us because we don't have all the money. Something must be wrong with us because we're not very powerful. How can we be the movement that's going to change the world when we can't even pay our own rent? And Paul says, you've got to consider the plan of God, brothers. God is not into taking the strong and bringing out stronger things. He takes the weak. He takes Shamgar. He takes Ehud. He takes Deborah. He takes a hooligan like Jephthah and uses him for his honor and glory. And boy, if this doesn't push our hearts forward to the Christmas story, that God delights in using the weak of the world to confound the mighty. You know, Matthew in his gospel actually uses Bethlehem as an illustration of this. Remember that? Where he quotes Micah, "O Bethlehem, you are smallest among the clans, and yet out of you is going to come the ruler. I'm going to use the weak to confound the mighty. I'm not bringing the ruler out of Jerusalem. He's not coming out of Rome. He's not coming out of the mighty cities. He's going to come out of this no-name little place called Bethlehem." It's the Shamgar principle. Do you see it? Using the weak to confound the mighty. What does it say that Jesus is born in a manger? And just miles away, you have Herod the great king, right? It's using the weak to confound the mighty. What does it mean when Jesus is on the cross dying for the sins of the world? A weak, broken man dying on a cross, and yet through that weakness, what does the text say? We are strong. Through that weakness, he brings about salvation. What does it mean when God takes a Matthew, tax collector, and uses that gift to write the first book in the New Testament? That's using the weak to confound the mighty. The Christmas story, when we see the manger and we think about that story, that is all about God using the weak to confound the mighty. We close with a thought that leads us to the Lord's Supper. As we think about these judges, this is quite a cast of characters. You have from Othniel to Ehud all the way to Shamgar. I think every personality that's ever been born probably fits somewhere in between those three, you know? And you know what the text teaches us? They couldn't get the job done. Not permanently. They would do some things, and then the people would fall into sin, and God would send up another deliverer. And every time God raised up a deliverer, you know what people were thinking? They were thinking, could this be the one? Could this be the one that will finally rescue us once for all? And it just let them down time and time again. What does this do to us today? It should push our hearts towards the one deliverer that Hebrews says can save them to the uttermost. That when Jesus made that sacrifice on the cross, remember what he said? It has been, finished, complete. Nothing can be added. Nothing can be taken away. It's permanent and it's absolute and it counts for us. Jesus is able to save them to the uttermost. As we take the Lord's Supper, we think about this. All those judges and the failure push us to put our faith in the one that can deliver us. And when we take the Lord's Supper, it pushes us back to remind us of the cross where our salvation was met.